This is WGTD. You're listening to Education Matters, the only weekly broadcast in southeastern Wisconsin devoted exclusively to a discussion of local educational issues. Education Matters is co-hosted by Dwayne Olson, a retired member of the teacher education faculty at UW-Parkside, Karen Sconsert, an associate professor of education at Carthage College, Mike Kehoe, a retired substitute teacher and a current special education support volunteer at Bullen Middle School in Kenosha, Chuck Wolbers, a special education teacher with Kenosha Unified Successful Transitions for Exceptional Students Program, and Steve Brown, assistant professor of educational leadership at UW-Oshkosh. Now, here's today's Education Matters moderator.
And a very pleasant good morning. I'm Steve Brown, welcoming you into Education Matters here on WGTD-HD, serving Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. I have two guests today on Education Matters. In the first segment, I'll be chatting with Louise Dubé, who is Executive Director of iCivics. And in our second segment, I'll be talking with Dr. Lynn Michael Brown, and she is a professor at Colby College in Maine, and we'll be discussing 8 reasons to empower girls in our schools. In our first segment of Education Matters, we will be looking at the new program called iCivics. It's a free online service, and it was founded by former Associate Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court, Sandra Day O'Connor. And now, Justice Sandra Day O'Connor.
I want to thank you for spending your valuable time trying to find new ways to bring rich and engaging civics education to your students. When I stepped down and retired from the Supreme Court, I thought that one of the most important things I could do with my newfound free time, if there was to be some, was to help the next generation become knowledgeable in civics and civic principles and as leaders. And as you well know, the knowledge of our system of government is not handed down through the gene pool. It has to be learned by every generation of citizens. And our nation's schools were established initially for the purpose of educating our young people to be good citizens. And by bringing civic education to the classroom, you're carrying out that very important mission. And to help support you in that effort, I have teamed up with some experts in technology and in education, and together we've created iCivics.org, a website where you will find free lesson plans, interactive activities, social networking tools, and online games to excite and engage your students. You may be surprised that I'm promoting civics teaching and learning using online media. I'm not an expert in it, but these are the new tools of civic engagement for the digital generation, the young people. And even a retired cowgirl like me knows that we need to use these tools to educate if we're going to inspire and interest today's young people to become active and knowledgeable civic leaders. So I hope you'll try out the materials on the iCivics.org website. Tell us what you think and what more we can do to support you. As you know, democracy is not a spectator sport. We have to participate, each of us, to ensure that government of the people, by the people, and for the people shall not perish from this earth. I know you will not let that happen on your watch. Thank you.
And I'm very pleased to welcome Louise Dubé to Education Matters this morning. And Louise, welcome.
Well, thank you very much for hosting me, Stephen. It's a pleasure to be with you and the folks in Wisconsin.
Just so our audience is aware, you have your law degree from McGill University in Montreal and also an MBA from Yale University. I know you started your position in July of 2014 as Executive Director of iCivics, and we heard Justice O'Connor give a bit of the background and the importance of civics education. But I thought maybe if we could just start with maybe talking and giving our listening audience a bit of background in terms of the overall focus of iCivics from your perspective as executive director.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much for the opportunity to do that. It's iCivics was really only an idea in Jess O'Connor's head and became a reality. We started in 2009. And I think at the beginning, you know, it was just something that was deeply important to her, but it was primarily related to the independence of judiciary. I think that's where the genesis of iCivics came from. She was on the court, and as she stepped down from the court, she retired, really felt like people didn't understand that if we elect judges, they may not be quite as independent as was originally structured in our system of government. And her solution to this was really to educate kids about our system, how it works, why you need to get involved, and what's in it for you. And as she went into this, she sort of devised this method, which you know now as educational gaming. And it's been tremendously successful. And so over the course of those years between 2009 and when I came in 2014, they gained a lot of teachers who became very excited about having access to free and quality civic education resources in a way that kids would actually want to do. So the whole premise for iCivics is let's put the students in the center of the action. Let's make sure that kids not only fill out a worksheet about what are the three branches of government, but let them become president of the United States for a time, try it out, try to see what it takes to be a president, see what kind of issues come to your desk, and then see if they can actually achieve their goals as president. Same thing with our game, Win the White House. Students run their own campaign for the presidency. They create their candidate. They create their platform. They have to defend their platforms with specific projects. They have to run a primary. They have to raise money. They have to put in appearances all over the country. And then over the course of many weeks, they either win the election or they don't. So that's what, when I came in 2014, there had been quite a bit of adoption, but really we hadn't told enough people about what iCivics was and why this was really very important. So that's what we tried to do. We tried to create a strategic plan and try to spread the word across multiple channels, either through media. We had an article in the New York Times, through conversations like this one, through letting teachers know all of the thousands of resources we have on the iCivics site so that they can make deeper and better use of it. And so we've been fairly successful. We've had over 20% increases in the traffic at iCivics year over year ever since then. And so we're really thrilled. Now, last year we had about 4 million kids on iCivics. And this year is crazy. I mean, with the election, we have seen increases of 40% in some days, some weeks, as related to teachers and students looking for resources about the election. So I think we'll definitely be up more than 20% again this year.
Mm-hmm. One of the quotes from Justice O'Connor that's actually on your website, she says, "The practice of democracy is not passed down through the gene pool. It must be taught and learned anew by each generation of citizens." As you think about those words, and as I mentioned to you before we started taping, that I actually use iCivics in my graduate school law course at the University of Wisconsin Oshkosh. Why do you think there is a lack of civic education in this country?
Originally, I mean, this line is probably my favorite line, the one you selected, Steve, from Jess O'Connor. It really was the original mission of schools, right? I think most of us know that is why we created schools. And we wanted to teach kids how to be responsible and engaged citizens and knowledgeable citizens. And we've really gotten away from that. It's a confluence of factors that have led to this, and would take quite a while to untangle. But just to talk about a few of them, we've really seen a push, sort of an unintended consequence of this sort of education reform movement. We went back to the basics of ELA and math, and these are all fantastic disciplines, and everybody is supportive of that. But as a consequence, and the culture of accountability, district administrators started to take time away from other disciplines to focus on those that are tested, right? I think that's a normal response, and one which has been very difficult for social studies. And I think really to the detriment of a generation of kids. So that pressure is definitely been felt. But even worse, within the social studies environment, civics itself, with very weak mandates. Almost every state has mandates for civic education of one kind or another, but they're very weak mandates. They're not tested for the most part. They're either in middle school or in high school, not necessarily both, and they are usually not a full course. They're part of a course. It's very easy to sort of follow them by the strict letter of the law, but not with the spirit that was intended. And so we've seen two separate issues here. One is that there's less civic education, and the second one is that there is a huge disparity in the quality of civic education that is directly related to income levels. Both of those are huge concerns for us. That's why we're committed to keeping iCivics free. But even with that, there is just quite a bit of out-of-school activities and civic-related activities that kids with more means get more of, and kids with fewer means get less of. So I think we've seen that trend over a number of years. I'm hoping that we're at the cusp of seeing it turn around. I think what's happening in the world right now is an indication of the interest in people coming back to what it means to be a citizen, what it means to be informed about politics and political issues, what it means to know how our institutions work, and also what it means to have a civil discourse. And I think all of those things are that have occurred have opened up people's eyes. And I will add one more thing. I think even beyond that, I think even corporations that are looking for able workers and who would have supported math and ELA as the core, the fundamental pieces of training kids, realize that in our next century, kids are going to have to solve very, very complicated problems, problems that require judgment, requires working across with people that you may not agree with. These are all the kinds of things that a civic education will train you for, and that is why it's so very important not to stray from civic education in schools.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned before that you've seen an increase in the online usage, if you will, but particularly during this presidential election cycle. And I think regardless of where someone sits or stands, whether they're a Democrat or a Republican or an independent, this has certainly been a most unusual election cycle. When you look at the dialogue that we see taking place around the country, what impact, if any, do you think this is having on our public or private school students right now in our country?
I think it's relatively complex, and we don't really know yet. What I can assure you of is that kids are very, very interested. They would like to have discussion. Circle did a survey on this. Circle, I refer to the group, the research arm at Tufts University. Does a lot of research into civic life, and particularly in terms of youth voting and civic education. They did a survey, and they really found that that teachers would love to do this and to teach, and that kids are very interested. But There's a lot of pushback right now because of the polarization to support teachers, and teachers are very afraid. I don't know what it's like in Racine or Kenosha, but I do know that in some, particularly in purple states, some superintendents have specifically said to their teachers, do not teach the election, because parents will not back them up.
Mm-hmm.
That's a huge problem. It's a huge problem for us, and we think it's simply not understanding how our democracy works. I think it's very important, because I think the kids are paying attention. I think they need to understand that there are institutions and that they work a certain way and that we have a historical basis. They need to learn the history of how these came about, and we need to let them talk.
Sure.
Let them take positions and have a discussion on controversial issues. And those are, you know, part of the 6 best practices in civic education. We need to support that. We need to stand up as educators for that proposition. But if you're asking the long-term consequences of this, I hope that one of the long-term consequences will be that folks will understand how important civic education is, and that we'll see a movement go back the other way. I don't know if it will have an impact on kids in terms of voting. You know, there's a lot of short-term memories.
Mm-hmm.
But I do hope it will engage them in, you know, during the course of this election, there were many times where the rules of the election became actually, you know, very actively discussed. Those kinds of topics, if fostered by the teacher in the classroom, can really lead to long-term engagement with the process, right? They understand more, so they pay attention more long-term. That's our goal. Our goal is to get them early, get them to understand, and then hopefully down the line, they'll pay more attention to political information.
Mm-hmm. Right, and you mentioned research. I was fascinated with the research that was done at Baylor University by Lecompte Moore and Blevins, the impact of iCivics on student core civic knowledge, and it's a publication from 2011. And by the way, for our listeners, if you're just joining us, I'm talking to Louise Dubay, who's executive director of iCivics. This is a free online civics education program. It was created by former U.S. Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, and we're talking about the iCivics program, and that you can find it on the internet at iCivics.org. The research that I just mentioned at Baylor University, I found it fascinating in that the fourth grade students particularly, they found that if these students are exposed or spent at least 30 minutes on iCivics and on the Your Interactive website at least twice a week for at least 30 minutes, that there was a significant improvement in their achievement test scores when it came to the subtests that they would take with regards to civics. And these test scores, and this was part of the study that they did. As you look at other studies and you look at the overall impact of iCivics, how do you go about actually evaluating how effective iCivics is long term?
Yeah. So we've done a number of different studies along those lines. So one is on civic knowledge. Do they know more about how our government works and how to be how the rule of law works, or in specific cases at the Supreme Court? And so we've worked with independent academic institutions that have fielded studies. And so we've been able to demonstrate that. We've also been able to demonstrate that students are better able to write essays, argumentative essays, as a result of going through our tools, specifically our drafting board tool. We've also documented that if they're exposed to our games, just about half of them will go back and play the games on their own unprompted, which is really nice because we know what they're doing when they're not you know, doing something like that on their free time. They'll be doing other less productive activities. So I was really thrilled to see that kids actually love playing the games, even outside of school. So what we try to do is to work with academic to field studies. They're all independent, and so we don't pay for these things. But you know, when they are able to get grant money, we support them. There's a more recent Baylor study that's coming out and is actually going to document the fact that after they play our games and are exposed to some action civics curriculum, which is how to get involved in the real world, they are more likely to indicate that they would like to be more involved in the real world later, pre and post test.
Mm-hmm.
So that was also really gratifying. So that's what we do. We try to work with different academic institutions to demonstrate that we have a long-term impact on the knowledge, the ability to write, and the long-term engagement with our democracy after they're finished iCivic. So we think it's not only while they do it, it's really much for the rest of their lives, because there's a lot of academic research about if you get a quality civic social studies education, you're more likely to graduate from college and to get good employment. And so that's what we're trying to do.
As you look to the future, what are some new projects that you are looking at in terms of iCivics that, you know, especially after this current election cycle?
So the first one, and we're pretty excited about this, so I hope your listeners will take a look at it. We are releasing a new executive command game. So we have executive command is the game in which the students become president and try to pass bills with the Congress and get declarations of war and sort of do all the things that a president would do. So we're revamping that game so that it can be used on tablets and as an app.
Mm-hmm.
And updating it with a lot new information and new, more international bent. We have more international conflict as we live in a global world. So that will release in early November, right after the election on November 9th. And then after that, you know, we hope that that teachers will use it. And then after that, we are beginning to work on Spanish. So we know we have a lot of English language learners out there who could benefit from having you know, English language supports for what is really very difficult vocabulary in some cases. So we're going to try to adapt our resources to Spanish-speaking English language learners.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a bit longer term. And then, as I mentioned before, we're building out this primary source reading tool called DBQuest.
Sure. And finally, if any of our listeners, after listening to this interview and going onto your website at iCivics.org, if they want to get involved, if they want to get engaged, how do they do this?
Well, thanks so much for that question. Yeah, so there are different levels of involvement. If you know, the first thing to do is to look at our games and hopefully assign them to your kids if you're teaching in the classroom right now. There are lots of opportunities for educators to get more involved with us. We are currently recruiting for our educator network group. The educator network is really a group of about 30 educators all over the country that get trained additionally. They get professional development. They get a lot of resources from us, and they also blog. They host webinars. They host visitors. They do a lot of things for us. We work together, and those are our most enthusiastic supporters, and we love our educator network. And then ultimately, you know, obviously we are entirely free, and so we raise every dollar every year. We're a small staff of 12 people, and all over the country, every 50 state. And so, you know, we have a donate page on iCivics.org, and we will really appreciate your support. It's you know, because we're so successful, is actually a more difficult problem in that we have to keep reinvesting in our technology and our, you know, our materials for teachers.
Well, I want to thank you for taking your time and talking to us about iCivics, and I know that this has been started out as a dream of Justice O'Connor. Louise Dubé, thank you so much for all the work that you and your staff and all the members of your governing board, which of course includes Justice O'Connor, along with current Justice Sonia Sotomayor, and of course others who are on your governing board, for being my guest this morning on Education Matters.
Thank you so much, Steve. I really enjoyed the opportunity to talk with you and your guests and your listeners. Sorry.
And we continue now with Education Matters here on WGTD Public Radio. And I am very pleased to welcome into our program today Dr. Lynn Michael Brown. And she's a professor at Colby College in Waterville, Maine. And she is a professor. And there was a wonderful article in Education Week, actually this current week, called 8 Reasons to Empower Girls in School. Girls Fueled Youth Activism Has Educational Benefits. Dr. Brown, welcome to Education Matters.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
First of all, besides your college degrees, you have a doctoral degree from Harvard, and you did your postdoctoral work also at Harvard in women's psychology and girls' development, and a bachelor's from Ottawa University in psychology. Where did you go to high school?
I went to high school in Maine, down east Maine, if anybody out there knows where that is. Mm-hmm. But right on the Canadian border, actually, where Route 1 goes into Canada.
Sure,
Dallas.
Sure. I know exactly where that is.
Yeah. Yep.
And I asked you that because one of the things I always like to ask my guest, and I've done this over the years that I've been one of the co-hosts for Education Matters, is who is one teacher that you can chat about briefly, who stands out in your mind, who had the greatest impact on you, let's say in high school, whom you remember, he or she, who had the greatest impact on you?
It's funny, you know, there were a couple, but I think probably the person I would select, her name was Kathy Corson. She was young. She was probably right out of college, you know, in her early 20s. And she was an English teacher, and she just, you know, had this wide open view. She was really creative and invited us to sort of be creative ourselves, and to really, you know, challenge. You know, this was in the 70s, sort of to challenge the status quo, to really think outside the box. And, you know, I was a working class kid, you know, sort of my family moved out of poverty into the sort of working class, middle class as I was growing up. And, you know, she gave me a sense of space and belonging, I think, in that classroom.
The first part of your article that's in Education Week, and our listeners can actually go to edweek.org if they wish and just read the article. And you start off with your article by saying, if ever there was a time to unpack the complexities of gender and power with K-12 students, girls in particular, this is it. And you talk about the Olympic Games and some of the sexist commentaries. And then also, not to be too political, but during this presidential election, there have been a lot of sexist comments made. And let me ask you this. As you have, as we all have, you know, listened to the presidential debates and the campaigns, and as a parent, what's just some advice if can be given to parents as children hear all these things?
That's a good question. I think it's really about being honest and open and inviting their questions, not sort of shutting down conversation about some of the words and the language and the issues that they're hearing about.
Mm-hmm.
Probably, you know, among their peers. Even younger kids, this stuff really makes its way into school fast. And I just think remaining open and inviting, you know, their sort of, you know, I guess asking questions ourselves really invites kids to ask questions. And I think, you know, that's kind of the beginning of helping them think critically about what's coming at them. And I think We have to start that early. We want them to not take things at face value and to really sort of begin to challenge and develop their own views. So I think beginning that, this, you know, it's kind of horrific as some of the language is, you know, provides an opportunity, I think.
The article that's in Education Week, before you get into the eight reasons in the article to empower girls in school, you mentioned that you work with elementary girls who map their schools for safe and unsafe spaces, and you talk about middle school age girls who protest dress codes and so forth. Maybe give us a little bit of background how this article came about. And I know your latest book, Powered by Girl, a field guide for supporting youth activists. Maybe if you could talk also a bit about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the book really was an opportunity for me to put into words and to put into one space the kind of work I've been doing for many years. I have three different organizations that are kind of, I talk about them as girl-fueled, meaning that girls really have the power to sort of initiate actions and sort of initiate debate and discussion around issues. One is Spark Movement, which has largely been online with girls around the country. Hardy Girls Healthy Women is a, you know, place-based kind of community grassroots organization where we do kind of develop critical thinking and activism with girls. And then Powered by Girls, an online blogging site for girls. And it's, we have a teen editor, and the girls sort of write blogs about issues that matter to them. And I know that all of these organizations and all of these actions really depend on adults to support and scaffold and, you know, offer resources to girls. And I just become more and more concerned about the way in which the media has been talking about girl activism as sort of special girls, the girls who sort of do all this by themselves, or pop culture feminist stuff, and, you know, really looking at the commodification even of girls activism. And I just wanted to write a book about the power of this intergenerational relationship, you know, how adults really can scaffold and support kids, and how important that is to raise kids who are civically engaged and really fully involved in a democracy, that we really need to take this seriously.
The first one on the list under the heading of Activism Moves Girls from Passive Consumers to Active Citizens. Why is that important?
Well, girls are getting all the time, you know, just bombarded by media messages telling them that, you know, the way to sort of move about the world and to be successful and, you know, even to sort of have social power, right, is to look a certain way, to have certain things, to sort of match up to certain kind of ideals, and those tend to be white and middle class and thin and, you know, light-skinned. And so it's a very narrow set of messages. And so activism really, because it's about critical thinking, it's about unpacking the kinds of messages that we get, you know, from not only from our communities and our schools, but from media, it really moves girls to sort of think through that kind of, you know, facade, or that kind, you know, to not take things at face value and to really challenge the messages they're getting. And so I think that, you know, it's that critical thinking that moves girls to sort of become more active and more engaged and more involved in their world.
One of the other reasons that you list is activism makes schools safer for all girls. And you say that girl-led activism helps to create a school climate where gender diversity is visible and valued. How is something like that actually put into place? If a school actually wanted to do that, because I know you work a lot with schools and you help to develop these kinds of programs. First of all, how difficult is it to actually implement that? And then how do you go about doing it?
Well, I think that, you know, if we create the space for our students to really think about, you know, what in their experience in their sort of daily lives feels hurtful or feels as though it's unfair, and those conversations can start pretty early, and then sort of begin to have a conversation about what are the possible solutions, what are things that we might do in our own spaces to sort of, you know, make our schools more caring or just places. That beginning conversation and that invitation to participate is a way in which we, you know, create space for all kinds of voices. And activism is really about speaking up and taking risks and saying what you feel and think. And when we invite girls to do that in particular, we create an environment that's safer, I think, for everybody, in particular girls who, when they do that, are disparaged or punished or disciplined. So it just, you know, it's really the process of an honest invitation and then following that through with kids and saying, what would this look like? You know, how could we imagine, you know, doing a project together that would make some kind of change for not just for ourselves, but for other people who are, you know, experiencing hurt in some way.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I don't think you have to do too much except for really honestly, carefully inviting and then being there when kids start to, you know, move into action.
You also mentioned that this activism also has a direct impact on affirming the power of diversity and the impact that it has in allowing girls in particular and actually seeing the differences in social class and race and ethnicity. How have you actually seen that develop in schools?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that we do at Hardy Girls is we have a curriculum, but and part of it is to sort of encourage girls to think about action projects and put them into practice. But they do that in sort of ongoing girls groups. And the best groups are diverse. You know, they cross social class and race and social groups, and, you know, they're gender nonconforming and gender conforming kids, you know, all in one space. And when you sort of ask those kids to really think about an issue that crosses all of their lives, that they could all feel passionate about and could all work on in coalition, because, you know, that's what a coalition is, right? People who are coming from very different places come together around common cause. And when they start to sort of do that work together, that's when all those stereotypes and all those assumptions and judgments break down, because you have to work together and you have to take risks together and you have to feel passionate about something together. And that, you know, really affirms, I think, you know, the power of, you know, different perspectives, different voices, you know, the power of diversity.
Mm-hmm. And the last item in your list of eight, and I'm sure these are not I know these are not in order of importance, because all of these are incredibly important, but you say that activism is the most effective form of leadership training. Maybe if you could elaborate on that, please.
Yeah, you know, I really struggle with the way, you know, particularly girls' leadership training has sort of adopted the kind of lean-in, Sheryl Sandberg's lean-in model, which is this sort of idea that, you know, what girls have to do is just sort of ask for a place at the table, you know, and recognize an opportunity and take it. And I think that's such a limited set of messages to give girls, because, you know, what if they get to the table with someone like Roger Ailes, you know, the Fox CEO who's was fired over kind of alleged sexual harassment charges. You know, what if that's the table they end up at? You know, the lean-in model has this kind of notion that, you know, the systems they're asked to lean into are fair and good. And, you know, in fact, they're often, you know, sexist and racist and homophobic. And so activism really is a way of challenging and really unpacking those kinds of systems to really think about, you know, how can things be better? You know, how can we imagine, you know, as Maxine Green, one of my favorite educators, says, imagine things as if they could be otherwise, or create a world in which there are different kinds of possibilities rather than what's been handed down to us.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's, you know, that's the real power of activist work. And that is leadership in action, right? I mean, in order to do that, there are all kinds of things you have to do that are kind of leadership qualities. You know, you have to think critically, you have to work with other people, you have to sort of take risks, you have to sort of see the big picture and make decisions. And, you know, it's not we're not preparing girls for some kind of vague future. We're saying this is how you do it. This is how a system operates. Think critically about it, and how are you going to sort of bring yourself fully to it and make it better? So I feel like that's really the definition of activism that's going to prepare kids to be part of, you know, be part of this world in a really positive way.
Mm-hmm. And it would seem to me that as you are doing all this and working with these various groups that you've helped to create and other groups with which you work, that you're also cultivating these, if you will, these zones for adolescent girls, which is a great lead-in to a keynote address that you gave back in 2001 at a Girls' Health Summit. And you have a wonderful quote in there by the wonderful writer Toni Morrison from her her book, The Bluest Eye. And maybe if you could read this quote and then why you inserted this at the very beginning of your keynote.
Absolutely. So Toni Morrison writes, "I talk about how I did not plant the seeds too deeply, how it was the fault of the earth, the land, our town. I even think now that the land of the entire country was hostile to marigolds that year. This soil is bad for certain kinds of flowers, certain seeds it will not nurture, certain fruit it will not bear. And when the land kills of its own volition, we acquiesce and say the victim had no right to live." Yeah, I love that quote. I put that at the beginning of this talk because it was a talk about cultivating, you know, spaces or enabling conditions for girls, particularly girls who are under stress, to sort of really flourish. And hardiness is a concept that comes out of health psychology that basically says, through lots of research, that people who are under stress need more control in their lives,
mm-hmm.
they need more commitment, and they need more challenge. They need to be able to be catalysts in their environment. And I also think about critical thinking as a 4C there. But this idea that if we can create the kind of conditions for kids to flourish rather than sort of blame the kids, you know, if they're not doing well in bad conditions. So this is really about thinking of hardiness as, you know, spaces that are nurturing, that are giving kids exactly what they need to, you know, be the not only be their best selves, but to really engage in the world in productive ways.
Mm-hmm. And you know, as this presidential election is winding down, and we hear all these comments that are being made at various levels. I know at the end of the speech that you gave back in 2001, you also quote Alice Walker, and I had the opportunity a number of years ago to work with her. But in her essay, In Search of Our Mother's Garden, Alice says that whatever rocky soil she landed on, she turned into a garden. It just seems to me that the work that you do, that oftentimes you are in settings and working with people who think that they are on those, you know, very rocky soiled parts of our world, and somehow you help along with others with whom you work in cultivating, and it becomes a garden.
Oh, thank you. I really appreciate that perspective. I feel like that is the kind of work I hope to be doing always.
And if our listeners want to find out more about the work that you do, what is a website they can go to? And then also, if they're interested in your new book, Powered by Girl, A Field Guide for Supporting Youth Activists, how might they find out more about that?
Well, they certainly can find the book at Amazon or at Beacon Press, the publishers.
Mm-hmm.
And they can find me at Colby College. So
okay.
I think just Google me at Colby. If they want to see the kind of work that I've been doing, they can check out Hardy Girls at hghw.org.
Okay, very good. I want to thank you for all the incredible work that you do and more so, you know, all the impact that you have on all the girls.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
I would like to thank my two guests this morning, Louise Dubay from iCivics, and also Dr. Lynn Michael Brown from Colby College talking about 8 reasons to empower girls in school. For Education Matters here on WGTD Public Radio, I'm your host today, Steve Brown. Thank you so much for listening.
You've been listening to Education.